I'm very happy to welcome to the Radio Cafe Alan Locus. He's founder of the Community Meditation Center in New York City, and he's author of the new book, Through the Flames, Overcoming Disaster Through Compassion, Patience, and Determination. He will be speaking tomorrow, Wednesday, the 1st of July, at 6:30 at the ARC Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. Happy to be with you.
So this is a story of survival. You and your wife lived through a plane crash on Christmas Day 2012. You were in Myanmar on vacation, and the small passenger plane that you were in landed short of the runway and crashed in a field. What happened next?
Well, first of all, we were in actually a legitimate-sized commercial plane, a plane that could hold 100. There were 71 of us on board. Officially, this was called pilot error. He misjudged where we were and came down way short of the runway. The problem was exacerbated seriously by the fact that when he came down, the plane sheared through electrical wires, and those wires sparked, burst into flames, and immediately before the plane even hit the ground, the plane was seriously ablaze, and that's what really caused our problems. The plane hit the ground hard and immediately filled with a thick black smoke, making it very difficult to see anything inside. I was able to push my wife out of an emergency exit that had flown open, even though that exit was engulfed in flames. I figured it was better for her to go quickly through the flames than to be stuck inside. I intended to follow right after her, but my foot caught on something, and I couldn't see what it was because of the smoke, and I was trapped in the plane, and I was actually right in the fire at that time. We don't know how long I was in the fire, but being in fire is just not a very good thing, so I was seriously injured to the extent that doctors just said outright that I wouldn't be able to survive. Those are the doctors there in Myanmar, or probably better known as Burma, and then Bangkok, Singapore, and same story in New York City.
You spent a couple of months in hospitals. You had third-degree burns over a good portion of your body. People said you wouldn't survive. One doctor did give you some hope. What was your own inner sense? Did you have an inner sense of whether you were going to live through this?
Well, I had no sense at all. I had no idea that I was injured. You know, there's a blank spot in my memory that's still there from the moment I realized that I was stuck and caught on something to the moment that I was then on the ground outside the plane. That's blanked out. That might be as much as 45 seconds. I know when my wife ran over to me and tried to get me away from the plane because she was concerned that it would explode, which it did, actually. She said, come on, we have to go. I know that I couldn't move my legs, but nothing was clear. I have memory of everything that happened, but I can't tell you where it happened or when it happened. And I certainly... In fact, I never knew how seriously injured I was until almost 2 years later. And that happened because I was doing a television spot for CBS Sunday Morning, and they asked if there were any pictures of me taken right after the accident. I knew that there were pictures, but I had never seen them. So I got those pictures, and when I saw them for the first time, then I realized why doctors said I wouldn't survive, because I was looking at someone who was really badly burned, and it's extraordinary that you can barely see that when you look at me. If I didn't really show you in detail my hands, you wouldn't. You would then see that they were scarred, but they still now, with a lot of work, have come back and function quite well. You don't see all the scarring on my legs because I'm wearing pants. You know, in terms of knowing what was going on, only on a certain level, but I never really knew just how serious the situation was.
What was it like at that moment when you saw those photographs?
Well, that was interesting. I had done a lot of work in a process called somatic experiencing, which we can call trauma therapy. And I knew exactly what to do. When I looked at the photos, it was as if I could see that it was me, but it was as if it was a different me, almost unrecognizable. And the first thing I did was I looked up and looked in the mirror, the same as I was a moment ago assuring the listeners that I was okay. I assured myself at that moment that I was okay. I was alive. I was doing well. But it was an experience not like anything that I've ever had to look at those photos. I still will look at them occasionally and sort of marvel that someone could live through that. It isn't a matter of denial that that was me, because I don't think I'm practicing denial at all, but just maybe a kind of separation between me as I experience me now and the person in those pictures. That person in those pictures was very seriously injured.
Now, your wife also sustained some very serious injuries. She broke 4 vertebrae in her back, and you were, of course, completely unable to take care of her, and she needed care for herself, even as she was taking care of you. What was this like for each of you?
Well, again, for me, I almost can't answer that because I don't have a sense of anything being wrong. I didn't know she was injured. She did. She was injured on impact, and her pain over the next 10, 15, 20 minutes was just increasing seriously to the point that within the hour she couldn't walk. We were very fortunate that there were local Burmese people who reached out and just wanted to help. One woman knew how to handle the system, which is very different than ours. But this woman knew how to pay off nurses so that my wife had use of a bathroom and she could buy toilet paper. She was able to get a wheelchair for my wife. But my wife, Susanna, was so focused on me and trying to keep me alive when she was being told that I wasn't going to live that she essentially bypassed her injuries. And it was actually months later before she began to address her injury. So she's still dealing with the results of those broken vertebrae. She has pain that she has to deal with in her neck. She's working on it. It's pretty persistent. There wasn't much that could be done for her. They put her initially into a brace that immobilized the area. We now feel it's questionable as to whether that was even the wisest thing to do. But when we finally saw x-rays, we saw that the breaks were in such a place that, you know, just another millimeter or two and she would have been paralyzed. So both of us, as bad as it was, really consider how we came out of this rather miraculous and absolutely extraordinary. So as a result of that, we try more than ever to use our time wisely and to do what we can for all those around us. It was a life-changing experience.
We're talking to Alan Locus about his book, Through the Flames. You are a longtime meditator and meditation teacher. How did your meditation practice help you and perhaps sometimes not help you?
Well, you know, that's a question that's right to the point, because meditation has kind of been the bedrock of my existence for more than 2 decades. When I finally came home from the hospital, I thought, whoa, this is it. Finally, things are going to get better. I can get back to my meditation. I can be healing. And it was exactly the opposite. That's when things emotionally really got difficult, very, very depressing. I was physically unbelievably weak. I often use as an illustration the fact that I couldn't press the button to turn on my toothbrush. I had lost 25 pounds off of a frame that was in fairly good shape. I couldn't walk very well. I had no use of my hands because they were still bandaged. And even when the bandages came off, my hands were very weak. They were ultra sensitive because, in a certain way, I had brand new hands. It was all new skin, so like a baby skin, and very tremulous. I couldn't feed myself. I couldn't do anything for myself, and that was very depressing. And all I could think about and all I could say was, I want my life back. I want my life back. And for Susanna, this was also a very, very difficult time. She even, at her lowest point, she said, it just might have been better if we had died in that accident. And when she said that, I just sank. I just felt so awful that I couldn't do anything for this person that I loved. And somehow we got through that. I guess that's very much what my book is about. The book Through the Flames does tell about the accident because it's necessary for the reader to know that circumstance. But it's really about how we came out of it. As to my meditation practice, it was then non-existent. I literally couldn't do it. I guess I didn't understand at the time, but my mind was not clear. I would sit with people who were visiting me, and I knew who was there. I knew who the person was, but I often had no idea what they were saying. I drifted in and out of being able to hear them. And when the mind is not clear and you can't focus, then the whole practice of meditation is essentially not going to be possible, because in the classical sense, and I practice in the classical tradition, you need your mind. It's what you're working on. You're observing the workings of your mind. You're watching what's going on. And then over time, with practice, you're able to make changes in the way your mind functions. Today, the scientists call that neuroplasticity, specifically changes in the brain, which 30, 35 years ago they thought was not possible. So my book and my experience is very much about this time of perseverance, determination, and being able to come back. When this actually turned around, I don't know, but fortunately for me, it did. And what I mean is, I don't remember a moment when suddenly things became clear. There was a time about 4 months after the accident when some of my students sent an emissary. They sent one of them to meet with me, and she said, we really need you back. We need for you to teach. And would you just take a few of us, a small group, and we'll come to you, and will you start to teach again? And I thought about that, and I thought, I have no idea if I can do this. I don't know if I can focus on anything. So we arranged the structure. The structure would be that the class would be based on their questions, that they would each come in with a question. There would be no more people in the class than could fit in my living room. And that was a big turning point. That first evening when I taught those people and answered their questions, I was just elated. I realized that I could do that. If I really focused, I could have clarity again. And that was a turning point. It was significant. And then I also started to write this book. And I didn't intend for the book to be therapeutic, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was very therapeutic. I knew that I was going through an experience that could be meaningful to other people, not because other people would be in a plane crash. I certainly hope that is never an experience that anyone else has. But in a certain sense, we're all going through crashes at different times in our lives. We call those crashes the death of a dear one. We call them divorce. We call them loss of financial security, loss of our job. And these are traumatic events. And I learned through my experience that we can make it through the most traumatic of events. And I wanted to share what my experience was. And, of course, a lot of it is based on my years of practice that preceded this accident. And I hope that I've been able to offer something in the book. I'm told that people have already benefited from it, and that feels really good for me to know that.
You seem to have extraordinary healing abilities, and you came back in so many ways that you weren't expected to. I mean, it's not just that you survived, but your skin healed really well. Your ears healed, which are cartilage with very thin skin on them. People thought you were going to lose them, and there they were completely intact. I mean, it healed. All kinds of things that weren't expected. How do you understand that?
I guess the most honest answer is I don't. I don't understand it. I do, you know, through the fact that all through my life I was essentially never ill. I probably got a cold on average every 10 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And even when I did, I sort of felt arrogant about it. How dare these bacteria, you know, take over my system? So I think I probably do have a very good immune system, but the physical healing from an illness is probably different than healing from injury. I know that since this question came up right from the beginning, and it was very much what motivated me to write the book, I began to look at what could have brought this about, this kind of healing. And I know, you know, through my reading and research for various projects, that the human body is rather miraculous. And it's almost as if the body knows it wants to heal. The body will do anything to heal as fully as it can. We see that even if we cut our finger in the kitchen. The instant that cut happens, the body is already starting to heal. And whether we do anything with it or not, within a few days or a week, the cut is healed. We get a cold, the body heals. There are times, of course, when the body can't heal, but it wants to and it tries to heal. So my thinking was the more I could get out of the way and let the body do what only it could do, the better off I would be. Then any way in which I could enhance that with the various therapies that I had to go through, physical therapy, occupational therapy, psychotherapy, massage therapy, for weeks and weeks I was seeing five therapists a week, and my life was all about therapy. But a key for me that I realized, because people, the questions that people were asking me, one of the questions that came up often was, didn't you ever ask yourself, why me? And I realized that I never did. I never asked myself, why me? I think if I ever had asked myself, why me, the only logical answer would be, why not me? Why should I be immune from accidents or illnesses or any other difficulties? They're part of life. But I think that when we get caught up in that, the poor me, why did this happen to me, or the more energetic part of that, which is blaming, someone is to blame for this. I'm going to get even. I'm going to get this pilot did that. Or, you know, the pilot misjudged. He didn't do it on purpose. He didn't want to get killed. Fortunately, he didn't. Blaming changes the way the body is functioning. And based on this experience that I've had, which was essentially letting the body do that which only it can do and trying to support it. It's part of the practice of somatic experiencing, which we can call trauma therapy. Thank the body for what it's doing. Encourage the body. Don't be angry with the body. And the SE therapists really believe that this helps a lot. And I guess now I've become a believer also, because other than that, I don't have an answer to your question. Sometimes we use the word miracle to try to put a label on that which we cannot explain. There doesn't seem to be an earthly explanation. So we label it. We call it a miracle. There undoubtedly is an explanation, but we just don't know what it is.
You said a moment ago, letting the body do what it needs to do and getting out of your own way. What are the ways in which we get in our own way? What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that there is often a sense of, I mean, I'll name a few of them, a sense of anger. Why did this happen to me? I didn't do anything wrong. I've always been a good person. I've tried to help people. I go to church. I go to temple. I go to the mosque, whatever. Why me? Why did this happen to me? And I think that that diverts us, because that question is not answerable. There really isn't an answer. I can tell you what the Buddhists would say. The Buddhists would say that in this unfolding of life's events, every moment that comes about because of the causes and conditions that precede and accompany this moment. I don't have any regrets whatsoever. For me, there's no one to blame. My wife and I made the decision to go to Myanmar, and it made a lot of sense. We were visiting a country that was just opening up. We wanted to support the work of Aung San Suu Kyi, who we really admire. She is now encouraging tourism in her country. It's very much a Buddhist country, and that's part of the practice that I follow, so I wanted to visit that. We chose the flight that we were going to be on, and we chose our seats. There weren't even assigned seats. We walked on the plane, and we were told, take whatever seats you want. And we did. Now, talk about causes and conditions. Just imagine this. The two people sitting directly in front of us got off the plane without a scratch. We were seriously injured, but alive. The woman sitting directly behind me died in that accident. So there are three rows of seats, uninjured, injured, and killed.
Yeah.
So if someone thinks there is an explanation for that, then fine, that kind of explanation can bring comfort. But I do think what gets in the way of healing is anger, blame, what if, I should have, why did this? Because those things are unanswerable. Learn what we can from the situation, and then take from the situation what we can do to help ourselves and to help others. Then I think we have the best chance to heal, and beyond healing, to thrive. I believe that I have really thrived since this accident.
We're talking to Alan Locus about his book, Through the Flames, Overcoming Disaster Through Compassion, Patience, and Determination. You know, you've put this example of the people in front of you left the plane without a scratch, and the person behind you died, and you were seriously injured, you and your wife. And it does bring up, I mean, I have to ask this, since you are a Buddhist practitioner, I have to ask the question of karma, and was this karma, and I don't mean retribution, but was this period of injury and suffering for you something that came as a result of your own actions somehow, as opposed to something that came about because you were in a plane on a foggy day?
Well, the law of karma is very, very complex. In fact, the Buddha actually said to his students, it would take a fully enlightened being to truly understand karma. And the concept of karma that has come to the Western world is not really karma as the Buddhists understand it. It's not a kind of linear tit-for-tat, do something good will happen to you, do something bad will happen to you. But an aspect of the question, as you phrased it, is true, that one, and again, I should say, I can only do a superficial answer to this, probably because all I understand is superficial, but then trying to explain it is going to be even more superficial. But let's see what we can do with this. The Buddhists say that we are creating our karma in the moment. Karma means, the translation of the word karma means action. So we are responsible for our actions, but we're not stuck with our karma. That's one of the misconceptions of the linear view of karma, that, you know, I made a mistake 2 weeks ago and I spoke harshly to someone, therefore now I end up in a plane crash. It doesn't work that way from the traditional and classical viewpoint. In each moment comes about as conditions come together, and that's a key aspect of karma. But in this moment, we can make decisions that change our karma in the next moment. So as an illustration, because this is a very sad news story, when we speak about these kinds of conditions, then we say, if a young man is spewing hatred directed toward a particular race or creed or religion, and we hear him doing that again and again, and we make a gun available to him, and then something tragic happens, we have to go back and look at the conditions that preceded that. And we look in an investigative sort of way, and we say, well, maybe we should have paid more attention to what this young man was saying and get a sense of, you know, is his mental health really sound? And should we allow conditions where someone like that has easy access to a firearm? Because when we look at what happened just a week and a half ago, when we look at that, we say the conditions came about that caused that to happen. We learn from that. We learn in a very, very sad way. But the way that we need to proceed is to change the conditions. You can probably pick up from that I am very much in favor of supporting some serious gun legislation. I know that the world doesn't necessarily all agree with me, but we have to look at, and that's a karmic imprint, by the way, what happened in that instance is about intent, the intent of the person who in this case caused harm and serious suffering, but that was not a clear mind. That was not a mind that we would say was really acting in a sane way and therefore understood what he was doing. And I suppose that there'd be those who don't agree with me about that, but giving the benefit of the doubt, no rational person is going to do what he did.
There was something interesting in your book that struck me as being so non-Western, and that is that the actions of karma are not about the deed, but the intention behind the deed. And I think in Western society and religion, the deed, what you actually do, is considered most important, the intention less so.
Yes, well, deeds, of course, are very significant. The point that you're quoting correctly about intention is that from the perspective of Eastern philosophy, we very often don't have control over the results that come from our intentions. So therefore, it's said that our karmic imprint is influenced by our intentions. In other words, if I am now speaking, something that I can't control is what is being heard. I have to pay very strict attention to what I'm saying, which is my intention, but how someone hears what I'm saying is not within my control. So the karmic imprint is said to be determined by intention. However, we also really must pay attention to our actions. Part of, since we're quoting this from the Buddhist perspective, the Buddhist's path, a major part of that path is called right action or skillful action, and that directly addresses our deeds. We want to pay attention to our actions. We want to pay attention to our speech as well. Speech is considered an action, but very significant part of our actions. Our speech has a great deal of impact in the world. So, yes, I think both are significant. Our deeds are very significant, but our karmic imprint is said to be determined by our intention.
There's a moment in the book where you quote Mark Twain as saying, "I have spent most of my life worrying about things that have never happened." And it's this whole piece about, and you illustrate it with an example from your own medical condition during this time, about how we tend to worry and over-worry. And it made me think about, I was listening to a radio program the other day in which a film and television producer was talking about how he was a major catastrophizer. He would think about every possible catastrophe that could ever happen. And he said, you know, it's really no way to live, but it makes you a very good TV producer. And I was thinking about the ways in which these really unhappy-making things do have their positive uses in certain professions. For example, I'm somewhat of a catastrophizer myself. It's not necessarily a good thing, but it does have its benefits. So these things become very complicated if your life is not a life of, I mean, you get to be a meditation teacher, that's great, but most of us don't.
Well, could we switch roles for a moment and maybe just give me some example of when what you're calling catastrophizing has been beneficial for you? And then I would better know how to address your question.
Yeah, I'd have to think about that for a moment. I don't know if it's beneficial, but I guess there are, you know what I think it's beneficial is I have a handbag full of first aid supplies. I have a really good knife in my car to cut myself out of the seatbelt should I ever be in a crash. You know what I mean? I mean, yeah. I have this sort of like Boy Scout on steroids attitude toward preparation. That's one example.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I don't know that preparation, if I'm understanding the word catastrophizing, I don't know if they're the same thing. I frankly think it's very wise to have a little bit of a first aid kit with you when you're in the car. I never thought about carrying a knife to cut my way out of a seatbelt, but that's not a bad idea. I was in a car accident once, and I couldn't get out of the seatbelt. I had to wait until the rather heroic fireman came and pried open the door and cut through that seatbelt. The catastrophizing would seem to me if every time you got into the car, you were really concerned that you were going to be in an accident. Because what that then does is take away any joy that can come from being in the car. And yes, I know if you're in traffic every day, that's not particularly joyful, but it's still different than bringing worry and concern into the car every time you get in. So preparation and catastrophizing, maybe not the same thing. You know, the quote that you mentioned that Mark credited to Mark Twain, he also had another version of saying that, which was, "My life has been filled with tragedies, most of which never happened."
Right.
And what that suggests to me is this degree of worrying and concern that interfere with the potential joys and delights and beauty of life. You know, life is like this tapestry into which is woven the events of life, which are wonderful and beautiful and delightful and difficult and challenging and tragic. It's all part of the same fabric. And I think when we see it that way, we have a more of a sense of equanimity. We're not getting so elated to the sky because the market is up and, you know, I have a couple of $100 more this week, or plunged into the depths because the market is down this week. And that's a pretty roller coaster way to live life, and I think it can kind of shred us emotionally. However, finding our own set point, this is the term that the scientists are using today, the set point of our level of comfort, our level of happiness, a level of comfort which says, I want to have a first aid kit in the car. It's just me. I think that makes a lot of sense. But to come into the car really petrified every time you get in the car is just making that experience difficult. I'd rather not drive. I'd rather ask someone else to drive or find another mode of transportation if possible. It's the creating of stories around actual experience. The Buddhists refer to it as the bare experience. Yeah, I'll give you a mundane example. I live in New York City, so we have here and there some irregular sidewalks, and one twists one's ankle, let's say, and you even fall down, and the ankle really hurts, and immediately and imperceptibly, the mind says, oh, I'm going to be late for work because I can't walk, and I was late yesterday, and now they're really going to be on me about I could lose my job. I'm going to be out of work. And what am I going to do? Now I have no job. I'm out of work. I'm not going to get unemployment because I used it. Oh, and everybody's going to hate me for this. My wife's going to divorce me. She's going to divorce me because I can't support our family anymore. Now I'm divorced and I'm out of work. Should I stop there? Because from the pain in the ankle, which is enough, that's enough suffering, we now write our stories. And these are the tragedies that Mark Twain was referring to that never happened. It's enough that I've hurt my ankle. Let's pay attention to the ankle. And maybe if we do, we can watch the pain subside and say, ah, I'm grateful for that. Let me get on to work now.
The book, Through the Flames, is not only a story of your survival, but it's very much a book that can help other people, as you say, who've been through crashes of their own, both large and small. And there's some, I mean, you describe certain meditation techniques, and I think one that is very interesting and very important is about ways to dissolve or reframe or interrupt the process of anger when anger arises. And at the same time, there's something that sort of stuck in me about that, which is, I mean, you write about how when you get to the bottom of anger, that there is no self that's being threatened, but that the anger is a process going on in your mind. But then I think, I mean, here you were going through a really horrible and traumatizing experience, but you ended up in the best hospital in Singapore, and you ended up with the best doctor in New York City, and you ended up with friends and family and strangers and loved ones supporting you in hundreds and hundreds of ways, large and small, and so many blessings that it felt like a rain of flower petals in so many ways. And that was your experience. And yeah, you could be angry at the guy who drove the plane or whatever, but then there's this other experience of people who aren't blessed, like people living under slavery or African Americans who are continually being hounded by the police and threatened and killed for no reason. And there is actually a threat to self. And there is actually reason for anger. And it's very hard for me to understand how you can reframe it in those situations.
Well, here's a view, and you're raising a very serious point, and one that I am as involved in as I can possibly be. Let's start from the perspective of what is anger. Anger is a feeling. It's a feeling that arises within us under certain conditions. Here we are back to conditions again. But anger is only a feeling. And I'm not saying that to say, oh, it's only a feeling, don't worry about it. It's a very real feeling, and it can be very powerful. But it still remains a feeling. So we don't want to identify ourselves. We don't want to characterize ourselves and start saying, I'm an angry person, or he is an angry person. No, it is the experience of anger that arises under certain conditions. One of those conditions may be the awareness of injustice, not only within our country, but down the street, right next door to us. But when we are overtaken with anger, the chances of our doing something that is really constructive, that can be of benefit, is diminished. When we acknowledge that anger, but wait, understand that we are experiencing anger at this moment, and look at our own history, each of us look at our own history and realize that if I wait, and actually some of us have adopted the phrase a sacred pause, in that pause, allowing time to see clearly, allowing time for that anger to subside, we have a much, much better chance of making decisions that can really be of benefit. We have a better chance of being heard. If I yell at you, you're likely to either just back away or yell back at me. But if I can speak to you calmly, I have a much better chance of being heard. And that's the approach that many of us are trying to take here, as specifically to the question that you raised of, trying to work with our brothers and sisters here to see what we can do about certain injustices that go on in our own city. But one of the things that I've learned from an African-American woman who's now on our board of directors at the Meditation Center is this exact process. She said, she described herself as used to be an angry black woman. And she said, all I did was create more anger around me. She said, now I feel like I'm accomplishing things because I have a better way to be heard by people. And I think she's absolutely right. Anger, in my experience, only serves a purpose if it motivates us to act in a way that is beneficial. But that's not likely to happen if we act while angry. There's a big difference there.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'm sorry, I must add something. This is not about denying anger or denying any other feeling. It's about acknowledging it, quite the opposite. Realizing I'm experiencing real anger right now. This is a time to just slow down for a moment. Let's let these fires cool. Then I can make wiser decisions. We must balance wisdom and compassion in order to really be of benefit to ourselves and others.
You write an amazing thing at the end of the book. We're talking about the book Through the Flames by Alan Locus. And that is that if you could turn back the clock and make that plane crash not happen, you wouldn't do it. Really.
Yeah. When I wrote that, I almost couldn't believe what I was writing. Well, let's be clear about one thing. If I had known before I got on that plane that there was going to be a crash, believe me, I would not have gone on the plane.
Right.
But the crash happened. Then I also acknowledge I don't have a magic pill that can turn back the clock. But at this point, and at the time that I wrote that phrase, it was about a year after the accident, what has come from that accident for me, what I have learned that I couldn't have learned any other way, what I have experienced that I couldn't have experienced any other way. You referred to it, the love, the compassion that just came my way, which was overwhelming, the support and the opportunities. I've been teaching for a long time. I've been very fortunate. I teach a very large community here in New York. But the opportunities that have opened up nationally and internationally to be able to share things with people, to try to be of benefit, these all came out of this accident. And these things are too precious for me to give back. Yes, I still deal with some pains in my hands. They mean nothing to me at this point because what I realize, I'm just looking at my hands right now, I still have hands.
Yeah.
I came very close to not having them. So a couple of pains here and there, they're almost welcome. But no, I wouldn't give this up now.
It's so interesting because, I mean, the way you write about it, and it's very honest and both vulnerable and factual and kind of almost like objective about yourself as you write. And one of the things that one sees as a reader is that, yeah, you didn't indulge in too much anger or why me or blame, but you did really feel grief and allowed yourself to weep when you had to, probably, I'm guessing, both with pain and with a kind of deep emotional release that is a healing thing. And there you were in New York, and psychiatrists were saying, oh, you're too emotional, you need drugs.
Right, that was in the hospital. Yeah, you're right. You know, I wanted to be really honest in this book, and there was a period of time when it was absolutely the most horrible time of my life. I never could have imagined that I could have felt that down, that hopeless, that I could have experienced such despair. But it's part of the human experience when something really dramatic like this happens. And I didn't want to sugarcoat it. Yes, I did come through the other side. And one thing that you notice in the book that I purposefully did to not sugarcoat this kind of experience, I went and sought out people who have not been as fortunate as I,
yeah,
who have had accidents or tragic situations and have been told they're never going to walk again or they have only a few months left to live. And I wanted to speak to those people. I wanted to get their perspective, and I consider that those four interviews with the people I spoke with and those four interviews in the book are among the most significant parts of this book. I learned so much from those people. So, yes, even though I went through a difficult situation, I am incredibly fortunate, and there are those who are not as fortunate as I. Yet what I learned from them is even if there's no cure, you can still heal. And that's a big lesson.
Alan Locus is author of the book Through the Flames, Overcoming Disaster Through Compassion, Patience, and Determination. He's founder of the Community Meditation Center in New York City. And he will be here in Santa Fe, New Mexico tomorrow, Wednesday, the 1st of July at 6:30 at the ARC Bookstore. We look forward to seeing you there, and thank you so much for your time today on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. I look forward to being at the ARC. I love that store, and I love the people there.
Excellent.